It's time for Driving Me Crazy, coming to you live from Beechtree Studios near beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina. This is the only show where a husband and wife drive, talk cars and life, and still love one another each day. Here's John and Laurie. Or is it Laurie and John? Oh, take it away, you crazy kids.
Actually, we're from our office and kitchen or living room in the house in Pinehurst. We're not even in a studio. We're like everybody else. We work from home.
I'm sitting on the sofa in the living room. Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning, Hezzy.
Good morning. What a pleasure. It's good to know that you're in a comfortable place.
Are you in your apartment still?
Yeah, absolutely. Are you kidding?
There you go.
Where am I going to go?
true enough. You know, before we got on the air, we asked you, you know, what's going on in New York, because we receive reports that the vast majority of office buildings are empty, and that there's no plan for people to return to the office until after, you know, till the beginning of the new year, often later, often never. And of those numbers, very low percentage will ever come back to the workplace. What's going on in New York?
Well, it's not just New York. It's really all over the country. People who used to work in the center of town, center of any community, such as New York City, it could be Los Angeles, could be Chicago, probably in Pinehurst as well, and Miami. If there's no reason to go to an office building because you can telecommute to work, what's the point? Remember, they used to say, well, the managers had to be there to make sure you were doing your job. No, you didn't. It was
just
politics. It was the lack of proficiency by whoever was your overseer to get the job done, because they didn't know how to manage people. So they were the ones that had deficiencies. But the worker, since they were hired, they had to know what they were doing. And if not, you could have fired them, but they never did because they were good. So there's no reason to go. And another thing is, why would you want to commute to work if you don't have to? I'd rather stay with my wife and my children, or my husband and my children, whichever way it is in your home, and get an extra hour or even two.
And have an office. Just have an office there. I know for any number of years now, literally, and thanks to Lori, she's always had me have an office in the house. But I go to work. I go to my office when I'm working. When I'm not working, I go out of the office. You know, we sit in the living room. We do other things.
Yeah.
But, you know, so you have a place to work. But it's interesting because, and I wanted to bring this up because Lori's talking about New York. Well, the same is true, I think, of Washington, D.C., because I own a home in southern Maryland, which is about a one-hour commute from the Beltway. And I decided I was going to sell my home. So I've been, you know, looking at other properties and that kind of thing, kind of get an idea of what it might be worth and so forth. Well, I came across a great statistic that said within the last month – there were 48 houses just in the area, my small area where my house is located, Chesapeake Ranch Estate. There were 48 houses for sale, and 90% of them sold within 30 days.
That's right.
Now think about that.
That's the same thing that happened in the New York Times reported that only about a week ago, that there was a 112% increase in purchases of homes in Westchester County, and they came from New York City. And there are increases like that everywhere you look.
Well,
Florida is a big destination as well.
Well, here in Pinehurst, which, you know, we believe is one of the most beautiful little towns in the country, and we live in a gated community called Pine Wild, which we love. Houses in Pine Wild go on sale and sell within a few hours.
Exactly.
It's amazing. It is absolutely.
But everything is changing. It's where people work is changing. Where people buy is changing.
Yeah.
Even when we talk about cars, for example, America's always been very different than the rest of the world. But if you've been abroad, you also realize that it's completely different. The cost of real estate in other cities is very high. So unless you're out in the boondocks somewhere, which is rare because you want to be close to your customers, they didn't have showrooms abroad. They had like one car representing the entire line of cars. You could have like 20 models, but they only had one car. And the size of the showroom was maybe, what we'd say, 20 feet by 16 feet deep. That was it. That was it. And,
yeah, that's
and
true of South
the rest
America,
of it was
for
done
sure.
through pictures.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because you can't, it's not affordable. And who knows if that's not going to come here to America.
Well, and they don't finance things a lot of times in Europe, especially, and I know they don't in South America. If you buy a car, you buy a car. You go in and you pay for the car. You know, it's not one of these financing deals. And it's the same as true of housing and stuff in South America. It's just you buy when you're able to. And it's a different mindset than we have here in the United States. So,
But our mindset was, and it's changing now. Because of COVID. COVID's shown us what we didn't want to see before.
Right.
But what about all the stores on Fifth Avenue? What about Bergdorf's and Tiffany's?
They're
Lord
They're closing. They're closing. Louis Vuitton was supposed to buy Tiffany's. $17 billion sale. Guess what happened? Louis Vuitton said, no, we're not going to do it. And Tiffany is now suing Louis Vuitton because they feel that they've been, I don't know, something's gone wrong for them, and they wanted to consummate the deal. So no marriage, though.
Right.
I don't know how long
it's
going to be in court. Absolutely. Even at the top end of everything you look at, everything has changed. Everything has been impacted. Amazingly so. Nothing is safe.
When I was young, 2 or 3 years ago, actually a lot longer than that, I would go to Bergdorf Goodman's, and there was one floor that had a sale department, and it wasn't even a big department. But when you went to Bergdorf's, you expected to pay whatever the ticket price was. There wasn't anything like a discount or a sale. You just because you were at Bergdorf's, you had the Bergdorf label. You paid because that was what they asked. There was no question. Is there anything that is for sale these days at full retail price? I don't think so.
Well,
not even on Amazon. Stop and think about it. This whole thing about Tiffany's is extraordinarily upsetting to me because Tiffany's was not just about selling jewelry or fine china or silver flatware. It was where you went when you were about to get married, or once you felt you arrived at a place in your career or your home to get the best, to get something. It was a status symbol, but not for the reason that word implies. It was a sense of achievement and fulfillment, and you knew that
it was an heirloom too. It was something that lasted for as long as you ever wanted.
Right. Exactly, honey. And the phrase, it's the Tiffany of, I mean, Tiffany has become an adjective. It's the Tiffany of all, you know, that's finest in the world. Well, what does that represent? That represents, it's almost like the Cadillac of cars. What Tiffany's represents is the fact that some people have been able, through their experience and expertise, to get the very best of something so that when you buy it, you are assured it is absolutely the best. And that includes not just a wedding ring or an engagement ring or something as to commemorate an anniversary. It's a life event. Mm-hmm. So when I was first married and went to Tiffany's to go on the bridal registry to pick out my china and my silverware, that established a precedent for the rest of my life on how I entertained. And now who the heck cares? I mean, it's just as expensive now to buy designer paper plates as it is to get something off of Amazon at a discount that's in China. I mean, a porcelain plate or a pottery plater. So that whole mindset is now gone. The mindset that you go to a Bergdorf's, you go to a Tiffany's for the best, so you look your best, you entertain your best, you live your best, it doesn't matter anymore. So what is the new standard? I guess that's my question.
I want to say
something. The new standard is everything is being reduced in prices. You see discounts in everything, including the very well-known products.
You know, wait, let me just say one more thing, sweetheart. You know, in the morning when people would get up, you know, get up and get dressed to go to work, men wore ties and jackets. They wore Brooks Brothers suits. Well, Brooks Brothers going down the tubes, too. And, I mean, so when you get up in the morning Oh, Barney's is done. And, you know, women would get, you know, they would get, their makeup was important, their hair, their nails. Mm-hmm. Now who gives a rat's, who cares? Sorry, who cares? Because now I know so many women that were professional career women that get up in the morning and stay in their bathrobes, stay in their loungewear all day long.
Right.
So what I'm saying is society is suffering as far as what we previously determined was the way we had to present ourselves to the world. Now nobody sees us except on a video screen.
Well, and I, that is something, that was one of the things I just wanted to address as you were talking about this. What's being hurt here, I mean, I understand the business is closing, life is changing, people are working from home, all of these kinds of things. I understand all that. But I think it's hurt us socially because you there was an interaction with the people with which you worked. Hopefully it was good. But you were around people. You were with people. You dealt with people. Now that we've become, we are becoming more of a stay-at-home, work-from-home type of society, we don't have that interaction. The only interaction is with our family. Nothing wrong with that. That's very good. But how do you socialize with your friends? Even if you go to a restaurant now, you wear a mask until you sit at the table, which only says to me that they've proven that the virus can't be caught if you're sitting down at the table. That's what one of our friends says anyway. So, I mean,
well, they're
supposed to
be divided by plexiglass, so you know, it depends on if they're really doing what they're supposed to do.
It's just, you know, but where's the social? Where's the social life? Bars aren't open.
Well,
it's
actually more important than the social life because when you worked in an environment such as a big corporate structure, you were able to bounce off ideas and issues and ask for advice from your comrades who hopefully will have shared that information with you. Now you don't have anyone to share any information.
Right.
The learning curve has been reduced and diminished, and we will realize that in a year's time as people go back to work and they end up working just from the home.
Right. Yeah. Interesting times.
One of the television series was The Office. And, of course, if you broadcast that brand new today, nobody would understand it because nobody's in an office. So what does this do? Pave the way for The Office online and everybody's on a computer screen interacting that way? It's very, very sad.
One of our friends sent us an email yesterday because we were trying to get in touch with him, and he sent an email and he said that he was, what is it called? It's not Face. What is the?
Zoom.
Yeah, he said he was he was in a virtual meeting for 2 days, and when he got out of Zoom jail, he would give us a call. So, anyway.
And we're going to talk about another wonderful truck this week in about 30 seconds after I make this comment. I just read that Hartford, Connecticut school systems are shut down because their online programs crashed, so they can't even reach the students that way. So does that mean we don't have educated? What's going to happen to this generation of young people?
Oh, my gosh.
This is all cash.
It really is. Well, you know, in the city of Yonkers, we were supposed to have installed a special high-speed, wire or system 3 years ago to speed up internet service. Well, now you can't. It is so slow. People don't even get emails in time. You know what? People lie all their lives, and government too. They're just doing such a lousy job of covering up because and it doesn't work. And you know what? They deserve to get exactly what they got. And it's time for people to wake up and tell it the way it is.
Yeah,
and you know what? It's not personalities that make a difference in government or in anything else. What matters today is only one thing: competence. Competence brings about trust. You don't have trust, there's no competence there to trust. So what are you supposed to do?
Right.
Point is, look at how many kids. You talk about suing people for you know, restitutions. If I were a child and I was the parent of a child, I'm ready to sue right now because they aren't up and running.
Right.
Or you get your kid out of there and then you go into private school, but not everyone has that option.
Or homeschooling, which is the grown by leaps and bounds in the last not very
Absolutely.
Long. My kids were
it's amazing.
We homeschooled my kids for, I think, 2 years, and simply because we were in a state where the school systems were next to the lowest in the country, so we figured we could do as good a job as they could. And it actually turned out to be quite good because all of the normal classes that we would, that I, of course, I was a teacher, you remember, and so this was after my teaching, or before my second one, but it was during those times, so I knew, and the kid's mother knew about teaching and that kind of thing. So, but they would work and do all the stuff and be done by probably 1 o'clock, you know. So after 1 o'clock, you know, then they were riding horses and cleaning stables and doing things that kids like to do anyway. So it worked out really well. I'm a big proponent of of that. Then they wanted to go to school because they wanted, they had friends, you know, in the neighborhood, and they wanted to go to school and socialize and do those kind of things. So we let them, and they were pretty much ahead of most of the kids by the time they graduated from
the real problem is that the manner by which so many communities are trying to recover, such as with the school system and the communication systems that are crashing or not working. Our electricity is not functioning. It took them 2.5 or 3 weeks to just bring it back up to snuff. I mean, it's insanity what people go through. But at the end of the day, I really wonder if we are not creating a new society in which we divide the disparity between our children and their prospects in life because we're not starting off right. And we need to educate them, and they're not being educated.
Yeah.
So it's a real problem, and it's not going to go away in a year.
Right. I agree with that.
So let's talk on that note.
We'll segue into vehicles.
The 2020 Sierra 1500 four-wheel drive crew cab AT4, and I just want to also add to this that my younger son Winston and his wife Leah are about to go bananas with trying to educate 5 children all under the age of 12. So there needs to be some kind of for they can't do it. With the demands online with their kids from school have just about put them into a state of shock. But anyway, let's talk about this great Sierra. Johnny, take it away, because you're the one that wrote up this wonderful column this week in the Yonkers Tribune. Go for it, hon.
Did you drive the car? You did drive the car.
I did, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll just lead off then, of course, and simply say that this is like truck week. This is our third truck in a row.
It's been truck month. Yeah, you know, we had the Expedition, and then we had the Ram 1500, which was an eco diesel 4x4, and then this one is the 2020 GMC Sierra 1500, which is also a Duramax. Yeah, it's Sierra.
Yeah.
The Chevrolet or GMC brand is a Duramax 3.3-liter turbo diesel engine. So it's a big monster truck, you know, that kind of thing. But very beautiful, and the interesting thing to start my part of this would be that when I was doing the research on this car, I went to GMC to bring it up on this truck, and there were only 4 colors, and it was like white, gray, black, and I don't know, something else, and it said that premium colors would be available later in the model year. Well, we got a red one, which means we got one of the later ones, so there were no pictures that I could pull from GMC of a red 1500 Sierra Duramax, you know, four-wheel drive, crew cab thing, AT4. So I went out and took a picture of the one in our driveway, and I think it actually turned out really good. It's a very nice picture of the vehicle itself. It's a stunning-looking vehicle, and I'm very appreciative.
I couldn't capture the photo, so I had to go and hunt down for a red one.
Did you find one?
So I found one, so I posted that one on top because I didn't have I couldn't grab the photo.
Yeah, and I didn't know how to give it to you because off of my phone I don't have a way to that I could figure out for you to get it. So, well, anyway,
but
at least
you
got one.
Red, and I didn't want to diminish the
by putting a black
the
one in there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sorry, I was doing the best I could.
Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
No, you did good.
Okay. And but anyway, this one, another 4x4. I really liked it. The thing about it, it's an AT4. Now, what does that mean? Because that's the big deal here. The AT4 means, according to GMC, it's more of an off-road performance package. That's what AT4 means. So when you're driving around town, yeah, all-terrain, four-wheel drive, I'm sure is what that means, off-road performance.
Yeah.
So it's a little stiffer. It's got a lot of things in it to protect the underside of the vehicle when you're off-road. It's got lots of horsepower with this big diesel engine. But, you know, it also has those tires, sort of the off-road type of tires, big, heavy-duty, deep treads. And so when you're driving it around town, you don't hear the engine so much as you do there is tire noise, you know, because those kind of tires make noise. The engine, both this one and the one we had last week, the diesel engine for the Ram and the diesel engine for the Sierra, are really, when you think about diesel engines, you think about them sort of rumbling and, you know, making lots of noise and lots of smoke and exhaust and that kind of, that's not true. Not true of either of these vehicles that we've driven last week or this week. And this one, it's actually quite quiet for a good-sized diesel engine. The other thing that I noticed about this is that, of course, it's a turbo. It's a 3-liter.
I felt that this was a tad bit noisier than last week's truck.
I'm not arguing with you. I agree with you.
And I also felt that last week's truck, even though it wasn't, it felt bigger than this week's truck.
Yeah, I'm trying not to do a lot of comparing. That's, you know.
But that's the end of my comparison. I don't want to compare. Go ahead.
Yeah, I didn't want to get into that kind of a thing occurring. But this one, I thought the tires gave noise. The engine was relatively, I mean, it's quiet for a diesel engine. But the big thing was that because it's a turbo, and you know that with turbos, most of the turbos we get, when you step down on them, there's this hesitation where whatever the number of cylinders have to get together with one another and decide what it is you're asking them to do. Not so in the one we had last week, and not so in this one. The response, especially for a diesel engine, when you step down on this diesel engine, it immediately picked up speed. Everything kicked in just like you would expect it to. It was very pleasant, very responsive, and of course, because it's set up to be an off-road vehicle, it handled very well. I mean, it's very crisp. The ride was actually very good, and you would think because of the things they put in to make it a little bit stiffer, a little bit more off-road type of thing, you know, it would be a little more difficult or
I got to ask you one thing, though. When you look at the rationale for getting the Sierra, does it really matter if it's the tires make it a little bit noisier? Because isn't that the reason that you need it? Otherwise, you wouldn't have this particular model.
That's the point, Hezzy. This thing is built for a specific need.
Right.
It is not something I would buy to drive around Pinehurst. That's not what it's designed for. You're 100% correct. This thing is built for whoever is doing off-road type of hauling, towing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's what it's set up for. All of, if you look at the dashboard, it's all set up for how you control the what you're hauling. Mm-hmm. It even has cameras that are specifically set up to look around the load. You've probably seen the commercials on TV. But it's so that you can haul something and actually see behind you, behind what you're hauling. So it's definitely built for a particular use. And it's a beautiful thing in red, but it is a particular, it's designed for a particular use. Which, you know, I think, again, when you talk about all the various models, this is the kind of model that is not going to appeal to that many people. It may from a... standpoint that, gosh, I think it's good looking and I want to buy one. But I think for the people who really use it, I don't know how many of those people are really out there. And I don't know how many people who would buy I think it was $64,000. It was a 53, I think, was the base. Yeah, and ours was $64,000. You know, from a business standpoint, am I going to spend $64,000 on a vehicle that I'm going to do a lot of this off-road stuff with? I guess. Well, you know, I guess it's meant to last, so.
Yeah, but here.
All the prices, you know, I mean, a regular lousy sedan costs $40,000. I mean,
The base on this truck.
Considering the prices are through the roof the last few years.
I agree with you.
That's the new price.
Well, the base on this truck is $53,000. That's not that bad.
Okay.
Yeah, but this one, our particular one now, because the AT4 package and the various things that they added to it, added almost $10,000, $9,665 in options that were on this truck.
What do you get for that? What do you get for those options?
Leather trim seats and stuff like that. But let me just say something because we're running out of time. You know, there are two factors here that kick into this whole
thing. I didn't spend the whole thing talking about Bergdorf or whatever it is.
Yeah, right. Here's the thing. First of all, we're seeing so many of the automotive manufacturers coming out with trucks. I mean, back to the point, we've got how many different trucks are flooding the market now in different options and different packages that makes the decision difficult? And largely today, we've been talking about a truck as though it was an extension of a family vehicle, whereas, you know, you do have people that have, you know, they're landscapers. They need a truck like that.
Yes, right.
Stuff. You've got people that have country homes
or
farms.
They
need a truck like this.
Yep.
So there will always be a need for trucks like this outside of the regular consumer market because it's their workhorses.
Mm-hmm.
They're specifically designed workhorses.
But again, and then let's talk about this more next week. The question is, in these COVID times, how is COVID affecting truck sales?
Vehicle sales, period.
Well, truck and car now are totally two different things because...
Totally different.
Yeah, you know, now...
The truck you need. So you need a truck to do the work. It's not to go to the theater, you know.
Exactly.
I mean, you could go, but you really need it for work.
The thing is, everything is changing in the world, and so bottom line is on this particular truck, utilitarian truck, great price for a base price for a truck, does it all. Is it a commuter vehicle? Of course not. Nobody's commuting. But is it a family truck only if you've got an opportunity to use it for your country house or something of that nature? It's a big, big truck to park.
Has he asked about the, you know, what did you get for the $10,000? I can tell you this much. $2,125 was in a technology package, and $1,095 was in a driver alert package. Those really were safety packages that gave you cameras, that gave you monitoring for the front, pedestrian, all of those kinds of things, lane assist. All of those were in those two packages, which was a little over $3,000. Is it worth adding $3,000 to it? Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a $3,000 worth of add-ons that I think are certainly necessary. Like Laurie said, the rest of it was, you know, a lot of it is the AT4 package, you know, which is off-road kinds of things, which if you need that, that's good. But if you don't, that's certainly going to save you some money. The other thing about this vehicle, which I think Laurie talked about last week, but I've got to get this in, is that this has a 24 mile per gallon average with a 22 gallon tank. Fill it up and you can go 528 miles. Now, the one last week had a bigger tank and went 700 miles. But the fact that you can go 500 miles in a vehicle before you fill up again, that's a big deal. It's a very big deal, yeah. I think, on a vehicle that's designed to do what this one's designed to do. Okay. Go, honey.
Well, next week, our time's up, so next week we'll talk to you about the new Kia K5.
Oh, okay. Great.
Right.
Oh.
And,
isn't that a renaming of a previous model? I know it's a K5, but it used to be called something else before.
It's part of the Optima family, and yes, it's been redesigned for 2021. So we have a 2021 sedan coming, and so we're off of trucks. It's a midsize sedan, and it was formerly known as, you're right, Hezzy, the Kia Optima. So now it's the K5.
Okay. Great.
And we look forward to telling you all about it, and it's one sharp looking car.
All right.
Thank you, Hezzy.
Thank you. Just be well. Stay healthy.
Everybody stay safe. Stay calm. We'll all get through this.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you. Bye. Oh, how exciting. So there we are with none other than Driving Me Crazy duo, John and Laurie Wild. Well, we've got an opportunity to engage in some, actually, for the next hour and a half, we'll have time to really delve into a lot of stuff. I don't think there's so much local because I think we've covered that. I think the local stuff that is actually interesting is this one. The former Mount Vernon Corporation Council, Lawrence Porcari, is expected to be sentenced for diverting $360,000 in Mount Vernon water funds to pay for the former mayor Richard Thomas's criminal defense and public relations firm. So, interestingly enough, in this particular case, evidently, and I didn't realize this before, I did when we originally wrote this years ago, the Mount Vernon Water Fund is not controlled by the city of Mount Vernon, and there are water funds in other communities as well. And those water funds are really quasi-government because the state owns it, and there is some aspect of it that is permitted to be operated through or under the guidance of the local community. And in this case, evidently, he's the corporation council. He's no longer the corporation council. But when he was corporation council, he studied the Mount Vernon City Charter to see if they could use this money for the criminal defense of the former mayor, who was eventually had to quit. But evidently, the charter says, as far as he was concerned, and he's got the legal mind, I certainly don't, he thought that it would be permitted. And evidently it was permitted under the law, except that the court seemed to believe, or their interpretation is that it was that Mr. Porcari fraudulently gave a rationale to the water fund, which was not correct. So they believe that he somehow massaged the issue, and he was able to get it under false pretenses, so to speak. So we expected the case to be resolved yesterday. However, it did not. So we'll probably hear from the judge, Judge David Zuckerman, on how he's what he's done with this particular case, probably sometime today. So that was one of the biggest stories that came out yesterday, and very, very important. And let me just see what else there was. there wasn't really all that much on the local level that was very pertinent, because a lot of it just kept on going and were repetitious of items that we've covered with you. So that becomes important. All right, so let's just look at what does matter on a more international scale. This is very, very frightening, because it must have just caused unbelievable pain and agony for a lot of people. Evidently, a huge fire broke out at Beirut, at the port of Beirut, 1 month after the fatal explosion. Well, a store of oil and tires at Beirut port caught fire today, a military source had said, a little more than a month after the massive blast had devastated the port mm-hmm. and the surrounding residential area of the Lebanese capital. The army said it was not immediately clear why the oil and tires had erupted in flames, and said it was sending helicopters to help bring the fire under control. Television footage also showed a helicopter dropping water on the blaze. The blaze erupted in the duty-free zone of the port, sending a huge column of smoke above a city still traumatized by the explosion on August 4th that killed about 190 people and injured 6,300 people. The head of Lebanon's Red Cross, by the name of George Ketaneh, said that there was no fear of another explosion as a result of the flames, and said there were no injuries, although he said there were some people suffering from shortness of breath as a result of the smoke. Television footage showed firefighters trying to douse a blaze in an area surrounded by the mangled remains of warehouses that were destroyed in the explosion last month. Now, the blast was caused by a huge store of ammonium nitrate that had been kept in the port in poor condition for years. So that was the rationale for what happened there. And this is a really big question. It's about COVID-19. The question is, who needs a test, when, and what becomes really a big question. Efforts to ramp up COVID-19 testing have triggered a rush on labs in several countries and spread confusion about who should get tested and when. So there are two types of tests that are available, diagnostic tests and antibody tests, and health authorities' current guidelines on testing. As they brace themselves for the long-anticipated second wave of the coronavirus pandemic, countries around the world rush to expand their testing capacities, taking their cue from those like Taiwan, Germany, and New Zealand that appear to do better in weathering the first wave. In many places, including France, the call for enhanced testing has resulted in long lines forming outside medical practices and pop-up labs amid an influx of anxious holidaymakers or vacationers returning from their summer vacations. Well, health workers have complained of tempers fraying due to the long wait. They have also reported widespread confusion concerning who should go for a test, which kind of test, and when. In late August, U.S. health officials sparked criticism after posting guidelines on testing from the White House Coronavirus Task Force that ran counter to what scientists say is necessary to control the pandemic. Seeking to clarify the recommendations, the head of the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, said that, quote, testing may be considered for all close contacts of confirmed or probable COVID-19 patients, only for critics to point out that, quote, may be, end quote, was not helpful for a confused general public. Guidelines for testing can depend on the stage of the outbreak in a given country or area and the local authorities' capacity to test. In cases of limited capacity, the authorities may decide to test only subgroups of suspected cases based on the availability of necessary equipment for testing or the level of community transmission of COVID-19, says the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control, the ECDC, a European Union agency. Using a resource-conscious approach, the European Center for Disease Prevention and Control has suggested prioritizing testing for a number of groups, including hospitalized patients with severe respiratory infections, symptomatic healthcare staff, and elderly people with underlying chronic medical conditions. As with face masks, shortages of which put government on the spot around the world, health authorities' guidance on testing has evolved in line with the availability of tests. Several countries that have built up large capacities now encourage all members of the public to seek a test even when they don't have symptoms. In France, which has a generous public health insurance system, all tests are reimbursed by the state. However, priority is given to people who have reported symptoms and obtained a doctor's prescription, or those who have been in contact with someone infected. To avoid a rush on labs and medical practices, Britain's National Health Service says that people should only get a test if they have symptoms or have been asked to get tested. And this will help make sure that people who need a test can get one. That's the explanation they give. Well, tests for COVID-19 include the polymerase chain reaction, the PCR diagnostic test, which involves a nasal swab, and the antibody test, a blood test that can tell whether the person was infected in the past. This is very interesting because, well, I'll tell you about that later in a moment. Antibody tests are useful to determine whether people have had the virus before, including those who experienced no symptoms. On the other hand, the antibody test is of little use to people who have had symptoms for less than a week, because it takes on average a week or two to develop antibodies. It should not be used to diagnose an active coronavirus infection, since antibodies can stay in the blood for several weeks after recovery. At this time, researchers do not know whether the presence of antibodies means that you are immune to the coronavirus in the future, or if you are immune, how long it will last. It is also unknown if antibody levels decline over time to detectable to undetectable levels. And according to research by Britain's Cochrane, antibody tests carried out 1 week after the first symptoms only detected 30% of people who had COVID-19. Accuracy increased on the second week, with 70% detected, and was highest in week three, more than 90% detected, before declining again in the following weeks. Because of this time lag, people who get tested within 8 days of symptom onset are advised to take a PCR test, which detects the virus rather than the antibodies and can therefore tell whether or not someone has been infected very early on. However, some studies have suggested that up to 1 in 5 tests may result in a false negative, indicating that the person does not have the virus when, in fact, he or she does. This can be due either to the timing of the test or human error during testing, which is why many health experts advise repeated PCR tests, particularly if symptoms persist. Well, people who report symptoms are advised to take a PCR test as soon as possible and self-isolate before and after the test, pending the result. The same applies to those who share a home with someone infected. In cases of more limited exposure, such as having a drink with someone who later tests positive, the contact person may wait 7 days before going for a test to allow for the virus's incubation period. Well, health experts have warned that people who get tested too early after exposure can end up with a false negative test, meaning they may later test positive. Those who have a negative PCR test and then go to be exposed or develop symptoms should be retested. Anyone who tests positive is required to self-isolate at home for a minimum of 10 days and until all symptoms vanish. And health officials in most countries currently require 2 consecutive negative PCR tests taken 24 hours apart before a patient is moved out of isolation. Both the World Health Organization and the Center for Disease Control also say people can be considered recovered and non-infectious 10 days after their symptoms began, as long as they have been symptom-free for 3 days. Well, there is something very interesting. I think it's the Pasteur Institute of France. They've created an ability to, with one prick of the finger, to cause blood to flow, and there's a system that they have where you connect to your cell phone with this unit, and that's part of the test. They give you the unit that I guess locks into your cell phone, and you could test whether you've got the virus, and also if you got the antibodies in one test. So very, very interesting that's all been put together. And it also gets tabulated on the internet. I guess it goes to one central place, and not for everyone to have, but it goes to a central place, probably the Pasteur Institute, and they will keep a deposit of all this information. But the point is, they have all the information, whether you were asymptomatic or never had it at all, and so on and so forth. So it's very interesting how this is going to be put together. But a very, very interesting sort of basis by which to put all this stuff together. And this is something very interesting on the world stage. The European Union is mulling legal action against Britain over British plans to break the Brexit divorce deal. Well, Britain and the European Union will hold emergency talks today over Prime Minister Boris Johnson's plan to undercut parts of the Brexit divorce treaty, with Brussels exploring possible legal action against London. After Britain explicitly said it would act outside international law by breaching the divorce treaty, European Union negotiators are trying to gauge how to deal with London. European Commission Vice President Maros Sefcovic will meet British counterpart Michael Gove, in London at 1200 hours Greenwich Mean Time, alongside scheduled trade talks between chief negotiators Michel Barnier and David Frost. If the European Union is unhappy with what London says, it could use a part of the withdrawal agreement to take legal action against Britain, though there would be no resolution before the end of the year deadline for Britain's full exit. The dispute-setting mechanism under the withdrawal agreement is there, a European Union diplomat dealing with Brexit told Reuters. Two European Union officials also involved in the talks said that the Commission would analyze Britain's proposed internal market bill, overriding parts of the withdrawal agreement, once it is passed, to take into account any amendments before making a final decision on the legal case. Well, the British government says its plans, a law, merely clarifies ambiguities in the withdrawal agreement, but also says its main priority is the 1998 Northern Irish peace deal. Europe's leaders have been handed an ultimatum, accept the treaty, prepare for a messy divorce when Britain disentangles itself from the European Union at the end of the year. Now, Britain signed the treaty and formality left the European Union in January, but remains a member of in all but name until the end of 2020 under a status quo agreement. And sterling was flat at $1.2999. Though overnight, sterling implied volatility rose to 13%, its highest since March 26, and the FTSE 100 share index slipped. Talks on a trade deal have snagged on state aid rules and fishing. Without an agreement, nearly $1 trillion in trade between the European Union and Britain could be thrown into confusion at the beginning of 2021, a further economic blow as they deal with the coronavirus pandemic. The latest dispute centers on rules for Northern Ireland, which shares a land border with European Union member Ireland. Under the 1998 Good Friday peace agreement that ended decades of violence, there must be no hard border in Ireland. To ensure that, Britain's European Union divorce agreement calls for some European Union rules to continue to apply in Northern Ireland, but Britain wants power to override many of them, acknowledging this would violate international law. U.S. House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi said any potential U.S.-UK trade deal would not pass the U.S. Congress if Britain undermined the 1998 agreement. Former British leaders Theresa May and John Major scolded Johnson, whose government put forward the Internal Market Bill on Wednesday, for considering an explicit intentional breach of international law. If we lose our reputation for honoring the promises we make, we will have lost something beyond price that may never be regained, Major had said. Well, European diplomats said Britain was playing a game of Brexit chicken, threatening to wreck the process and challenging Brussels to change course. Some fear Johnson may view a no-deal exit as a useful distraction from the pandemic. Well, I'm not optimistic at this stage, Irish Prime Minister Michael Martin told national broadcaster RTE when asked how confident he was in a trade deal being reached. Well, I think yesterday's development, because it undermines trust in negotiations, makes it all the more difficult to get to where everyone says they want to go, which is a free trade agreement with no tariffs and no quotas. Very, very compelling sort of information. Now, U.S. wildfires are destroying towns turned deadly as they rage across the West Coast. An unprecedented spate of fierce wind-driven wildfires in Oregon have all but destroyed five small towns, leaving a potentially high death toll in their wake, the governor said on Wednesday as initial casualty reports began to surface. Hundreds of miles away in Northern California, three fatalities were confirmed on Wednesday from a lightning-sparked conflagration that roared back to life with greater intensity this week after firefighters had made significant headway containing it. While more than two dozen major blazes continued to wreak havoc across the wide swath of California, the neighboring state of Oregon bore the latest brunt of wildfires plaguing much of the western United States over the past week. And the deadly wildfires rage across America's west coast, stoked by fierce winds. Winds of up to 50 miles per hour sent flames racing tens of miles within hours, engulfing hundreds of homes as firefighters fought. At least 35 large blazes across areas of Oregon, roughly equal to nearly twice the size of New York City. Well, several Oregon communities, including the town of Detroit in the Santiam Valley, as well as the Blue River and Vida in coastal Lane County, and Phoenix and Talent in southern Oregon, were substantially destroyed, Governor Kate Brown told a news conference. This could be the greatest loss in human lives and property due to wildfire in our state's history, Brown said, without providing details. Brown described rescue teams saving evacuees by pulling them from rivers before they took refuge from where they took refuge from flames. A 12-year-old boy and his grandmother died in a wildfire burning near the Santiam Valley, a community of Lyon, about 50 miles south of Portland, KOIN News reported. And further north, multiple blazes also raged in Washington State, where a one-year-old boy was killed and his parents severely burned fleeing a fire in Okanogan County, police had said. California officials said some 64,000 people were under evacuation orders on Wednesday, while crews battled 28 major fires raging across portions of the most populous U.S. state. A third of those evacuees displaced in hard-hit areas of Butte County, south of Sacramento, where a wildfire has scorched more than 200,000 acres since it was ignited on August 17. The remains of three victims were found in two separate locations in that fire zone, according to Butte County Sheriff Corey Hones, bringing the total death toll from this summer's devastating spate of California wildfires to at least 11. And residents of more than a dozen towns, including the city of Oroville, were told to flee immediately or be prepared to go at a moment's notice. The fire raged perilously close to the outskirts of Paradise, a town largely incinerated in 2018, with 85 lives lost in a firestorm that ranks as the deadliest in California history. Unbelievable. Now let's look at this report. Trump evidently intentionally downplayed COVID-19 despite knowing dangers, says a new book. Let's see if we can listen to this report. Bear with me a moment. One second. We'll get there in a moment. Okay.
Certainly, I'm not going. A stunning admission from Donald Trump in advance of the release of an upcoming book, Rage, by veteran journalist Bob Woodward. He released audio of an interview he conducted with Trump in February, less than a month into the epidemic.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes.
Because I don't want to create a panic. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
Trump also told Woodward of the virus, "This is deadly stuff. It's a vastly different story than he was telling the public."
It's going to disappear. One day it's like a miracle. It will disappear.
Dozens of times in the first 3 months of the epidemic, Trump downplayed the virus or said it was under control. Thursday, Trump himself addressed the controversy, basically restating what he had told Woodward.
Well, I think if you said in order to reduce panic, perhaps that's so. The fact is, I'm a cheerleader for this country. I love our country, and I don't want people to be frightened. I don't want to create panic.
Trump's Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, jumped at the chance to make it a campaign issue.
He knew how deadly it was. It was much more deadly than the flu. He knew and purposely played it down. Worse, he lied to the American people.
In the U.S., the coronavirus has claimed the lives of nearly 190,000 people. One study has estimated that if the country had imposed social distancing measures in early March, some 36,000 lives could have been saved.
Well, okay. So that's that story, which is really something that I guess we should all know. One second here. This, I think, you'll find interesting just because it's the global wildlife populations have dropped more than two-thirds since the 1970s. The World Wildlife Fund has revealed. So bear with me a moment here. Okay.
An increasingly rare sight, which could soon become even rarer. That's according to a new WWF report claiming that since 1970, global animal populations have collapsed by more than two-thirds.
It's an accelerating decrease that we've been monitoring for 30 years, and it continues to go in the wrong direction. In 2016, we documented a 60% decline. Now, we have a 70% decline. All this is in the blink of an eye compared to the millions of years that many species have been living on the planet.
The report says humankind has impacted 75% of the planet's ice-free land and 40% of the world's oceans. That's due to overfishing and agricultural expansion, which encroaches on natural habitats, leaving many animals without sufficient resources of their own to survive. A third of all land and the majority of fresh water now goes to producing food, and we're simply consuming far too much for the planet to sustain us. Species are collapsing faster in some areas than others. Central and South America saw a 94% fall as compared to 1970.
We need to act now. Rates of biodiversity recovery are typically much slower than those of recent biodiversity loss. This implies that any delay in action will allow further biodiversity losses that might take decades to restore.
As humans continue to encroach on natural habitats and increasingly come into contact with wild animals, it also increases the risk of future pandemics.
Well, so really important news, to say the least. This is mind-blowing as well, because who would have thought that deadly flooding has spread across Africa's Sahel region? Listen to this. This is absolutely mind-boggling. Second. All right, we'll get this in a moment. Okay.
In the Sahel region, the worst hit country has been Sudan. Floods there have killed more than 100 people. This is footage of southern Khartoum.
We've
never seen such floods. My family lives here for more than 100 years. I've lived here for 40 years, the same. There has never been a flood of this magnitude. There has never been so much destruction.
Another Sahel country where the floods have wreaked damage is Niger. More than 60 people have died. In the capital, Niamey, those who have lost their houses have gathered in this camp for displaced people.
All those who are here have suffered from the flood. We don't know where to go. We've lost everything, no water, no toilet.
Deforestation along rivers is one of the causes of the floods, as people cut down trees to make charcoal. Another problem in Niger is that the floods have destroyed more than 5,000 hectares of crops, especially rice fields. In Senegal, officials said 6 people had died. President Macky Sall has been criticized for the government's response. On Tuesday evening, he went on national television to defend his actions. He promised a package of 5 million euros to those who had lost everything.
Wow. Boy, there's so much stuff that goes on. When you think about what's going on around the world, it's not easy. This is very interesting because the chief of Charlie Hebdo says there's nothing to regret over Prophet Muhammad's cartoons. So let's just hear what's going on here. Bear with me a second. Depend a moment. Okay.
More than 5 years after the massacre at satirical weekly Charlie Hebdo, survivors told of their pain, but also spoke of freedom. The magazine last week republished the cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad that drew such controversy in 2015. Speaking in court on Wednesday, Charlie Hebdo's current director, known as Riss, defended the decision, saying freedom of expression has to be kept alive. Former webmaster Simon Fieschi suffered damage to his spinal cord after being shot in the neck. In court, he said the bullet didn't miss him, but also didn't get him, using it as a metaphor for how the newspaper recovered. Doctor and former columnist Patrick Pelou echoed the message of defiance.
Islamist terrorism will never bring down our republic, and we will always be stronger than them, and that's it, he said. And I mourn my dead friends every day. But here we are, and we carry on.
The trial, which began on September 2nd, is expected to continue until November. The defendants are 14 alleged accomplices of the gunman that targeted Charlie Hebdo and a Jewish supermarket, killing 17 people.
Yeah, okay. So let's see what else is going on around the world. We had mentioned this before. Tiffany and company will sue Louis Vuitton Moet Hennessy after the French retailer cancels a multi-million-dollar deal. So this is, let's see what this is.
We are Hooked on Media.
Okay, 1 second. Okay, we should be able to get this in a moment. There we go.
Sound of the turnaround of business, and who better to join us than Kate Moody? Good evening to you.
Hi, Mark.
the major deal between two luxury giants is on the rocks. That was Kate's pun, not mine. Partly because of the French government. Do explain.
Well, Mark, it's a complicated story, and it'll perhaps not surprise you to learn that it does involve Donald Trump. The American jeweler Tiffany is planning to sue LVMH after it backed out of a $16.2 billion takeover. Now, the Paris-based fashion giant said the French government had pressured it to delay the process as it weighed the next move in a transatlantic trade spat. Luke Trigo explains.
Did the French government just torpedo the biggest deal the luxury goods industry has ever seen? Not according to government sources. They say a letter sent to luxury leviathan LVMH asking it to defer acquisition of U.S. jeweler Tiffany & Company for $16 billion was in no way binding. Rather, Paris was apparently seeking breathing room to assess the fallout from potential new tariffs from Washington, mostly on the luxury sector.
In a context of international negotiation, that is very significant. With our partners, the French government is neither naive nor passive. We have goals that we want to achieve. There's a current discussion with a certain number of partners, especially the United States.
The U.S. has threatened to slap 100% tariffs on $2.4 billion of French products. Establish a tax on global tech giants, something that has for now been postponed until December after the U.S. presidential election. LVMH has insisted the letter was legal and valid, leaving the conglomerate no choice but to further defer an already delayed closing past November or walk away. However, it comes against the backdrop of a luxury sector stricken by coronavirus and evaporating consumer spending. Tiffany saw successive losses in the first and second quarters of 45 and 29% respectively. Its share price has been trading $10 below the $135 LVMH agreed it would pay last year, leaving some asking if it wasn't overpaying for the U.S. company. Tiffany, for its part, is pushing forward and is taking LVMH to court to get the deal through.
Tiffany headquarters in New York, based in Trump Tower. Well, meanwhile, the French finance minister, Bruno Le Maire, has said that the United States is blocking talks on those international taxes on digital giants and that Europe should prepare to go ahead with a regional plan by the end of this year. France's so-called GAFA tax was what sparked this chapter of trade tensions with Washington, and it's a clear sign that the tussle is far from over. Let's take in on the day's trading action now. Wall Street has rallied from its big losses earlier this week, slightly paring back by the close. The Dow Jones ending about 400 points higher. It had been up as much as 650 earlier in the session. The heavy NASDAQ closed up about 2.7%. Its major components, including Apple, Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Tesla, had lost a combined $1 trillion in market value in the last three sessions. All of them ended higher this Wednesday. Shares of Tiffany had dropped as much as 10%. They closed down 6%, while LVMH closed flat in Paris. The major European indices also rebounded after their sell-offs earlier this week. The London FTSE 100 and CAC Gallant in Paris each gaining about 1.4%. Shares in Frankfurt and Milan were closer to 2%. The British pound, meanwhile, dropped to a six-week low against both the euro and the dollar amid renewed Brexit uncertainty. Moving on to some of the day's other business headlines now. United Airlines says it's reached a preliminary deal with pilots' unions that would reduce the number of layoffs in the coming months. The carrier had planned to cut or furlough some 16,000 employees. This deal could save some 3,000 jobs. Other U.S. carriers are also planning major cuts starting in October when the terms of their federal aid packages are due to expire. Ryanair has further cut its annual passenger target from 60 to 50 million, saying it expects this winter travel market to be a write-off. The low-cost carrier says it will further slash prices to entice flyers. Boss Michael O'Leary has lashed out at the British government's handling of the pandemic, notably criticizing its quarantine policies. He told the BBC UK airports should expand testing to allow for the safe return of international travel. And the Trump administration is preparing an order that would ban imports of products including cotton, textiles, and tomatoes from China's Xinjiang region. Formal announcement is pending. It centers around allegations of forced labor and the mistreatment of Uyghur Muslims in that autonomous northwestern territory. And Mark, of course, that region also the focus of a separate controversy with human rights activists criticizing Disney for filming its latest hit, Mulan.
The Mulan filmed in that Xinjiang province where all the atrocities against the Uyghurs allegedly, well, documented filmmakers proved they're being carried out, including documentary filmmakers here at France 24. Kate, thank you very much indeed.
Okay, so let's just see what else is going on. There's much more. One second. One second here. This is interesting because this is new. Evidently, it's a saliva test. The question is, could it be a COVID-19 game changer in France? So evidently, offering painless, non-invasive, and rapid results, saliva tests have potential to change the way we live with the coronavirus. Imagine if you could pop into your local pharmacy on your lunch break, buy a cheap COVID-19 test, spit into the test tube, and have the results before you return to your desk. This could soon be a reality, providing a better way to live with the virus while waiting for a vaccine. The most common test currently used in France is the nasal version of the polymerase chain reaction PCR method, which involves inserting a long cotton tube into the patient's nose. It is carried out without referral or appointment at laboratories across the country. And for free, if you have the national health card, the lines are often long, and the results can take up to 5 days to arrive. More than 700,000 nasal swab tests are now carried out each week in France, in line with the objectives announced by the government the day after the lockdown ended. The Minister of the Health, Olivier Véran, estimates that France will be able to carry out 1 million tests per week if necessary, speaking to a government press conference in August 27th of this year. So the nasal swab test is uncomfortable and involves a risk of contaminating the person performing the test. The person being tested often has a rejection reflex, involuntarily coughing, sneezing, or even spitting on the healthcare professional holding the swab. And saliva tests have the advantage of being simpler to perform, less intrusive, with fewer risks, and the results can be processed more quickly. Studies are underway to assess the reliability of saliva tests, which could soon be quick and easy, said Véran. While France is still doing research on the feasibility of widespread saliva testing, this type of test is already being used in Hong Kong and the United States. Now, a recent study has shown that that the results of the saliva test may even be more reliable than those from nasal swabs, and people might also be more willing to get regular, repeated tests if they do not involve a painful procedure. When a pupil in France is suspected of having the virus, his or her whole class may be sent home until the COVID-19 test results come back. If the child tests positive, the whole school may be closed. More than 20 schools have already been forced to close across France since reopening just last Tuesday. With a saliva test, a school nurse could quickly test the child on the premises, and if the illness turned out to be nothing more than a fever or a stomach bug, the school can continue operating normally. The same practices could be applied to offices as well as airports or other hubs. So very, very important for that. Now, so we'll just have to see if that's going to be employed. It's going to be very, very interesting. Seems like a way to go if you can do it. This is very interesting as well. While the Chinese and Australian relations are souring, they're forcing a rethink on trade. And this is going to be very interesting how this will come out. Relations between China and Australia continue to decline on Tuesday after the hasty departure of the last remaining Australian journalist in China. The move comes in the wake of Beijing's imposition of trade sanctions against Australian goods, which could trigger a rethink of Australia's decade-long economic reliance on China. The two journalists, Bill Birtles of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, and Michael Smith of the Australian Financial Review, AFR, arrived in Sydney on Tuesday. The Australian government had warned the journalists to leave as tensions escalated over another Australian citizen, television anchor Cheng Lei, who is being detained on allegations of endangering national security. The two men had been kept from leaving China until they were questioned before about Cheng, AFR, and in a statement added that they were told they were persons of interest in an investigation into their colleague. An Australian diplomats negotiated their departure. It is the first time since the normalization of relations between China, Australia and China in the early 1970s that there are no Australian journalists in China. The ban on the Australian journalists is part of a wider China crackdown on Western journalists, with more than a dozen U.S. journalists from the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post also having been targeted. For Australia, however, the ramifications run particularly deep and reflect an unraveling of ties with its top trading partner. It felt very, very political. It very much felt like a diplomatic tussle in the broader Australia-China relationship, Birtles told ABC, or Australian Broadcasting Corporation Television, on Tuesday. Professor Steve Tsang, the director of the SOAS China Institute at the University of London, told Franz van Katte that the Australian government will likely become more cautious and conditional in its engagement with China going forward. The Australian government would be seeing that China has not been the benevolent friend it perhaps thought it was, Tsang had said. China is Australia's largest trading partner. In June of 2020, Australia's exports to China reached a record 14.6 billion Australians, about 9 billion pounds. So that's about, you know, more like about $11 billion and accounted for 49% of Australia's total export goods. Well, this year's record was reached despite sanctions that Beijing imposed on Australian beef, barley, and coal, and anti-dumping tariffs of more than 200% on wine. The trade barriers were thought to be retaliatory after Australia Prime Minister Scott Morrison called on world leaders in April to back an independent inquiry into China's handling of the COVID-19 outbreak. And Beijing said the move by Australia was politically motivated. Dr. Pak K. Lee, a senior lecturer at the Kent University specializing in Chinese politics and international relations, said the call was a major turning point in Australia's relationship with China, whether wrongly or not. China believed that Australia was doing the U.S.'s bidding, Dr. Lee said, but Australia itself has mounted concerns over China's external behavior in the South China Sea and over alleged China's political intervention in its domestic politics by Chinese diasporas. Well, Australia has refrained from a tit-for-tat response, even as China continues to pile on trade sanctions. But Australia is treading cautiously as it, quote, does not have many other options available for its commodity exports and cannot readily find customers other than Chinese importers. Another Australia, within Australia rather than debate, has become highly divisive. In one camp are those advocating for closer ties with China who are worried about the economic fallout for Australia. On the other, and are those citing Beijing's apparent pursuit rather of self-interest and the danger of becoming an economic dependent on Chinese trade. Professor Tsang said there were risks for any country that relies on trading predominantly with one partner, and particularly in the absence of shared democratic values. It's a risk for any country that is heavily traded or trading with one partner and where the country values aren't shared, he said. So Tsang also noted that China's newly assertive style of statecraft, named after a popular action film, had also increased feelings of competition. Meanwhile, Australia or any other country except China's wolf warrior approach to diplomacy, there are going to be certain elements of tension, he said. China will not be satisfied unless Australia accepts playing second fiddle to the Chinese. Well, the friendship enjoyed between Australia and China had begun to unravel even before the pandemic. China's attempts to suppress pro-democracy protests in Hong Kong in 2019 led to street clashes in Sydney and Melbourne between students from mainland China and those from Hong Kong. In expressing concerns to China over its response to the Hong Kong pro-democracy movement, Australia risked hurting one of its biggest export earners. Foreign students at Australian universities were 200,000 Chinese students and nearly 12,000 from Hong Kong are enrolled. China's image internationally may remain tarnished for some time, not least among ordinary Australians. In a Lowy Institute poll, quote, it was called Understanding Australian Attitudes to the World, taken before the Australian government's push for an inquiry into the origins of COVID-19, perception of China had already undergone unprecedented shifts. More than 9 in 10 Australians say they favored the government working to find other markets to reduce automatic dependence on China. The poll concluded that the trust in Trump in China was at its lowest point in the 10-year or 16-year history of the polls, with 23% saying that they were a cause, some other type or some other deal or whatever to act responsibly in the issue. So that's the story there. Well, it looks like we're at the end of our ropes with you today. Bear with me a moment. I'm going to just see who we have scheduled for you tomorrow. Tomorrow, we're going to be speaking to Nader Sayers. He's the assembly member representing District 90. Always compelling story and discussion with him. So hopefully you'll tune in then. Until then, I want to thank you for being with us. Oh, look at this. Century 21 has filed for bankruptcy. Just came in over the news wires. Unbelievable. Well, there are many upheavals. Many upheavals all around the country and all around the world. It's going to be not easy to engage, that's for sure. All right, well, let me just say thank you for being with us today. Hopefully you'll join us tomorrow and then the following week on Monday as well. So let me just quickly go back here. 1 second. Where are we here? Okay. I think we're at it. We're fine here. Oh, it looks like I may have been missing one thing here. And, okay, this one is going to be, I have to resurrect a page in order to, let's see, 1 second. Let's see if we get this done. We need to shut down the studio screen. There we are. All right, so we'll have to wish you a a good day, and hopefully you'll join us tomorrow with Nader Sej and the assembly member. So we'll speak to you then. Take care and goodbye. Thanks for joining us today.